This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. If you think that your doctor really listens to you, you might be one of the lucky few, or you might need to think again. According to research, doctors prevent patients from finishing their opening statements about what's ailing them nearly 80% of the time. Do you have a health concern? Well, in most cases, doctors give you just 18 seconds to explain before they interrupt. So talk fast, because they're busy. Critics say that kind of encounter is typical, and it isn't just rude and insensitive. It means too many misdiagnoses, too many tests, too little quality care. My guests today argue that the relationship between patients and doctors is due for a fundamental rethink. Not less talking, but more, and more listening, too, by patients and especially by doctors. Joining me are two doctors to make their case. Lena Wen is an emergency physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Joshua Kozowski is the vice chair and the clinical director of the emergency department there. Together, they've written a new book. It comes out today called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. And welcome to both of you. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. And listeners, we're going to invite you into this conversation. We're talking about doctors and patients and how they can communicate just a little bit better, a lot better. We'd like to hear your story. Have you had trouble talking with your doctor? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also post a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me start, if I could, with a real story about a diagnosis that went badly from your book. You open the book with the story of Jerry Robertson, who got the health scare of his life. He's 48 years old, a mechanic, big, strong guy, but not in great shape, who spends a day helping his brother move. The next day, he wakes up feeling tightness in his chest. He thinks maybe he pulled a muscle, but his wife is worried. He goes to the ER. And pick up the story, Dr. Kozowski.
And isn't that always the case? It's your wife who makes you go to the emergency room, right?
Right.
So, yeah, he's scared. He's never had chest pain before. And as far as he's concerned, this is something that is an emergency. And he appropriately goes to the emergency room where he is greeted by a triage nurse who takes down what we call the chief complaint. And in his case, the chief complaint was chest pain. And unfortunately, it was that chief complaint that then led to a sequence of protocols and pathways that he found himself trapped in for about the next 24 hours.
Trapped in this long series of procedures. He's also scared. It's unpleasant. And you talk about him being subjected to a sort of cookbook approach to medicine where doctors follow algorithms and pathways in their approach to diagnoses. Describe this cookbook approach to medicine. What is that?
So rather than taking a story from a patient that would have a narrative beginning and end, what doctors are often trained to do is to look for keywords or key phrases that can get you onto a pathway and to go through a series of checklist questions. Where does the pain? How long have you had it? Where does it radiate? What are the associated symptoms? And based on those questions and answers, they put you on a certain pathway towards different tests. And those tests are designed to rule out certain things, like a heart attack or a blood clot in your lungs, really important things to rule out, but are not necessarily any more helpful at getting you towards a real diagnosis.
And so what happened to Jerry, and what should have doctors done differently?
So in Jerry's particular case, he goes down the quote-unquote chest pain pathway. He has a series of tests to look at the functioning of his heart, of his lungs. All of the tests are normal, but again, it's very hard to rule out anything definitively, and so he's kept for additional testing overnight. And all along, he's not told what exactly is going on. What the doctors should have done, in our opinion, would be to take a history from the very beginning that would actually get them closer to the real diagnosis, which in this case was a simple muscle strain.
And they might have figured that out if they had just learned a little bit more about him, what he'd been doing maybe the night before, just really basic stuff, right?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily take a long time. You mentioned that doctors tend to interrupt patients within 18 seconds, and that's true. It probably takes more than 18 seconds to tell a compelling story. But it doesn't necessarily take any longer than it does to go through a long litany of questions, which don't really get you any closer to a real answer.
Now, Dr. Lena Wen, let me come over to you, because you have a rather personal story that explains why you got involved in this project and writing this book.
That's right. When I was a second-year medical student, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer that was widely metastatic. And she was only diagnosed after a lot of misdiagnoses. Actually, she had been telling her doctors for months, nearly a year, that she was having all these pains throughout her body and this discomfort, and they just weren't listening to her. Mm. And even though I was a medical student and knew something about the medical culture and the medical vocabulary, I still felt like I could not advocate for her. Mm. And so just like in the case of Jerry, she was ushered down all these pathways to look for things that she didn't have, but nobody actually paid attention to her. And so that's why I was drawn to figure out how we can better empower our patients to get the care that they really deserve.
Well, I want to talk about that, and we will get to that. But in this book, you both are advocating for a much more thoughtful form of engagement between doctor and patient, for a better, leaner, and individualized care for each patient, starting with an accurate diagnosis. But is this possible, given the current demands on the system? I'll start with you, Lena Nguyen. I mean, we all know how under pressure doctors are. You write that they typically have 12 minutes to see a patient. So it seems like what you're advocating for is for time that just isn't there. Or are we wrong about that?
No, absolutely. We emphasize in this book, too, that the fault is not with doctors. I mean, doctors nowadays are under so much pressure to see more and more patients, and they have a lot of demands on their time, too, in terms of using the newest technology, and their incentives are to do more treatments and more tests rather than less. So it's not necessarily the doctor's fault. But that's why we say that the action actually lies with the patient, that there's something that patients can do to advocate and say, I want to make sure that I get my diagnosis. I want to make sure that I understand every test that's done. There needs to be a reason for everything that's done to me, because this is my body and my decision. So we think that it's not a question of time, but rather about engagement. And thoughtful engagement.
So, Joshua Kozlowski, what's the best way to sort of take that on as a patient? Does it just mean being more assertive when we're there in the examination room?
Part of it is being assertive and recognizing that it is about you and that your voice has to be heard. But there are some specific tips that we talk about in our book that can help you help your doctor be a better doctor. Mm-hmm. We call them the 8 pillars of a better patient-doctor relationship. The first one is to practice your story, because if you can't tell your story in a short period of time, if your story is going to take you 30 minutes to tell, then chances are you're not going to get the whole story across.
Mm. So it's like applying for a job. You have to have your elevator pitch about your ailment.
That's exactly right. And in the same way that if you were going to make a pitch to your boss or meeting with your congressperson and having a quick conversation with them, you have to hone that message so that your doctor can hear it. That's the first step. There are several additional steps. The last step being that before you leave the doctor's office, you've got to make sure that you've at least talked about what your diagnosis is. And we spend a great deal of time explaining what diagnosis, which for some people is a scary word, what diagnosis really is and how that process is really meant to involve patients.
Mm. You talk about a number of ways that patients can empower themselves, and some of it's really basic stuff. Lena Nguyen, I mean, for example, who am I talking to? Right? I mean, are you a nurse? Are you an attending physician? Are you a medical student? I mean, we need to know that, right?
Right. And sometimes patients come in and say, but I've already told my story to 5 people. I don't understand why I'm telling you again. But it turns out that they had just told the receptionist and maybe the triage nurse and then maybe another nurse and maybe a medical student. And so it's important for doctors, certainly, and nurses and so forth to identify themselves. But we also say that there are things that if they don't do that, that you as the patient can do something about.
Yeah. I want to come back to this idea that you started talking about, Joshua Kozlowski, and that is this idea that doctors will spend a lot of time trying to rule out the worst case scenario, and that sends people down this road of test after test after test. Isn't that in some cases a good thing? I mean, most patients won't be worst case scenario, but for the small percentage that are, isn't it important to zero in on that? And sort of how do you distinguish between the two until you know?
No, absolutely right. There are certain conditions that are what we would call can't miss diagnoses. And particularly where we practice in the emergency department, where patients come in with undifferentiated complaints, foremost in our mind are making sure that this is not a life-threatening emergency. But doing that does not necessarily require exhaustive testing. We feel that with a good history, you can very often figure out what the diagnosis is, and the best way to rule out a diagnosis is to make another diagnosis.
Mm. It's interesting, too, because you talk about this sort of cookbook style medicine contributing not only to poor care and unnecessary testing and everything, but of course ballooning medical costs, which is a big issue these days.
Obviously, cost is on everyone's mind. It's on the forefront of our discussions around payment reform. But at the end of the day, our thesis really is not about cost. Mm. Even if healthcare somehow was all paid for, the risks and benefits of these tests are not necessarily in favor of patients. And so even if these tests were free, the idea of subjecting yourself to radiation and invasive tests, not to mention the time and the anxiety, not always pays off.
We're talking, listeners, to Lena Wen and Joshua Kozowski. They're two Boston-based doctors. They've written a book that's just out today, When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. And they're really talking, I think it's fair to say, about a minor revolution in the sort of doctor-patient relationship here. And we'd love to have you involved in this conversation. 800-423-8255. We've got some folks standing by. So let's go to Nick, who's calling from Belmont. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to suggest that it's not so much a question of the pressures on the doctors here, but a culture in which doctors are not to be challenged, are seen as all-powerful, and are in many ways treated as the all-knowing god of the medical profession. And in a culture like that, why would one listen to someone as untrained as a patient?
Lena Wen, what do you think?
Nick, thank you for calling in. You make an excellent point that the way that medicine has traditionally been practiced is with the doctor as the driver and the patients taking a back seat to their care. But we think this is really bad for your care. I experienced this firsthand, right, as a caregiver to my mother, and I saw exactly what happens when you don't advocate for your care. You know, patients feel like they don't want to be the bad patient, the troublemaker, and as a result, they don't really tell their doctor what's bothering them. But that just ends up being bad care for their patients. I mean, we see so many patients who don't want to tell us that they stopped taking a medication, for example. But then their doctor then gives them more medications because they feel like maybe that first one wasn't working for whatever reason. And so it does take a change in mentality and a minor revolution, as Anthony was saying. Mm. But at the same time, it is something that really must happen, Nick.
And you talk, both of you write about this in this book, about this goes, I guess the question is, how did we get here? And one of the answers is how doctors are trained. And Lena, you wrote early in the book that your teachers expounded on the virtues of algorithms and pathways and this kind of cookbook medicine. So how much of this has to do with the way you all are trained, and how do we undo that?
Medical training is to be blamed for a lot of what we're seeing. One of the examples actually that Josh told me early on is how he sees medical students in the beginning of their training, and they all want to hear the patient and to spend a lot of time listening. But then even in their third and fourth year of medical school, but especially as residents, because of time pressure and because of their role models that they see, they end up saying, okay, let me just do these checklist of things and go in and ask a patient, do you have chest pain? Do you have shortness of breath? Do you have headache? And that's it.
And why does that happen, Josh? I mean, because I wanted to get to this. I mean, my guess, I've never trained as to be a doctor, but I'm guessing that a lot of you look at what you're doing as an art. I mean, it's science, it's expertise, it's empirical evidence, but the best doctors have this instinct, this sense of humanity, and we often talk about the art of medicine. So how do we lose sight of that art of medicine to this checklist and algorithm approach?
So we are a immediate gratification society. Mm. And I think in some ways medical education has fallen prey to that. You mentioned the art of medicine or the instinct. Those things take time. You don't come out of medical school freshly minted as an MD and have those skills. It takes training. It takes practice. That's why we call it the practice of medicine. It takes mentorship, apprenticeship. These are things that in the old model of medical education were routine. Mm. But now it's much harder to find. Education is more fragmented. It's more routinized, and people come out with an MD and are thrown into a situation where it's about just learning the technical parts of their job, super specialized, but they don't necessarily get that training in how to become a better doctor each day. And I can tell you as I sit here, I consider myself a better doctor than I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But that doesn't come from knowing more algorithms. That comes from experience and being willing to get better. I think as long as medicine believes that we can just promulgate an algorithm that anyone can follow, we won't have that sort of sense of real art and training in medicine.
Mm. Well, let's get some more calls into this program. Kate is calling from the Back Bay. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on what Nick was saying about challenging a doctor, or at least speak and let your doctor know what's going on. My experience was very frustrating. I was referred to a specialist by my doctor. I was experiencing severe pain in my head and my neck, and then it will go to my hands and my arms. And when I went to the specialist and I explained to her what was going on, she decided to prescribe anxiety for me, an anti-inflammatory. And I tried over and over to explain to her that I don't need anxiety medication, but she insisted that I would need to try it for 4 months. And I absolutely refused. And I had to do my own investigation and read about it more on the net, and then contacted my dentist, who I trusted, and told her what was going on with me, until we found out that what was causing my pain so severely was a reaction to another medication that I was taking. Hmm. And once I stopped that med, I felt at least 95% better, if not 100%. But I tell you, I filed a complaint to the hospital where I went. I refused to pay my bill to that hospital, and they apologized.
Well, Kate, it sounds like you told a story of really doing your homework and being really taking control of your medical care. What did you hear Lena Nguyen in Kate's story?
Yeah, unfortunately, Kate, we hear so many stories like yours ever since we started writing What Doctors Don't Listen, and now that we're going around the country talking to patient groups, we hear so many people who come to us saying that they have had frustrating experiences with their doctors. They weren't happy with the care that they got. And what I heard from your story was that you knew something was wrong. You knew that whatever the doctor was telling you just didn't make sense. And so you really took the initiative to go the extra step and research it yourself, which is what we think is really critical.
Yeah.
I would also add that one of the things that maybe you mentioned in the story is how you got these anti-anxiety medications to just try. We think that throwing medications when you don't know what's going on isn't the best idea, that you should always have a diagnosis in mind, or at least the doctor should tell you a working diagnosis, which is most likely what you have, because otherwise, what are you treating?
Hmm. What I heard in Kate's story, Joshua Kozowski, is just, we've been hard on doctors here, but patients really need to take responsibility too and sort of take this bull by the horns, and it sounds like that's what Kate did there.
It does, although I would say that the first part of the story that I heard was this decision to refer to a specialist in the first place. And I'm wondering what the conversation would have been like if Kate had spoke to the primary care doctor and said, why are you referring me to the specialist? What types of diagnoses are you considering in the first place? Maybe it was the wrong specialist to begin with.
Mm.
So I think the conversation has to start very early on. Really, the minute you walk in the door, your doctor is already starting to make some judgments about what the diagnosis is, and you need to be involved in it.
Hmm. Let's go to Bonnie, who's calling from Needham. Hi, Bonnie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just fascinated by the conversation. I just really believe, I've had the good fortune of having really good relationships with doctors over the years, and I do believe that the patients that I'm 71, and I think that in my generation, we were trained somehow, psychologically and otherwise, that you go to a doctor, the doctor will have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't get involved. It's sort of like a child and a parent relationship. And over the years, I would always understand that doctors, they're humans, they can make mistakes, and definitely, I had men in my life who would refuse to go to the doctor. I practice with my husband before he goes. The practice is, can you talk to me a little bit about what that pain is like? He has a hard time doing that. And so practicing that and letting them know that, you know, we take better care of our cars. If our car isn't getting fixed by one mechanic and we keep taking it back to the same mechanic, then we have no compunction about going to try to find someplace else to try to, you know, get some conversations with people about it until we get something that's satisfactory.
Bonnie, I really appreciate the... Yeah, Bonnie, I'm going to, just because we've got some other callers to go to, but I really take your point, and it sounds like this is another sort of call for patients taking more responsibility for their own care. This is what I'm hearing from Bonnie, is it?
Yeah, and I really like the way you put it in terms of practicing with your husband. In fact, one of the questions that you were describing was, can you tell me more about what that pain feels like? Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful question. It's open-ended, and it really gives you as the patient a chance to describe and tell your story. What happens, unfortunately, is when you get to the doctor, they'll try to pigeonhole you. And instead of asking you a question like, can you tell me more about your pain, they'll ask you a question like, tell me when it started and tell me when it stopped and tell me what made it better and what made it worse. And those questions can be confusing if you're not prepared in advance for a story that has a little bit more narrative and makes a little bit more sense.
Let's go to Danielle, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Danielle. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, loud and clear.
Great, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just one quick point. I am also a physician, and I tend to work a lot of nights, so I'm always admitting patients, which is when we get the most of the history. I think it still is critical, of course it's critical, to listen to the patient, and this is what I love about my job. I can really listen to what they're saying when they come out of the emergency room. But I think we cannot trash the pathways, because what they do, in my experience, they make sure that we're not forgetting something critical. So I think number one is we must listen to our patients. I always tell my patients, you are the boss of you, so you have to tell me. And then the second thing is that the pathways just help to make sure that we're not missing something critical, that we're not just stuck down this one road, and we must make sure that we have a good differential diagnosis.
Okay, so Danielle, it sounds like you're advocating for something of a compromise here. Lena Nguyen, when she's talking about not trashing the pathway is one of the ways, one of the sort of algorithms for understanding what's going on. Do I have that right?
That's right. So a pathway we also use synonymously with recipe or algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Although we do say in the book that we are not against pathways of all types or checklists of all types. In fact, what Danielle said is really true, that sometimes it's good to have a pathway or a checklist as a final check to make sure that we haven't forgotten something that's really important. In addition, we also think that pathways or checklists for treatment are a good idea. So if you have a complicated case, like you have a complicated chemotherapy that you have to do for your cancer, or you have a high stress situation where you have a heart attack and you want something to be done, pathways are actually a good idea to make sure that emotions don't run high, you're forgetting something highly complicated. What we emphasize, though, is that pathways are not good for diagnosis, because you don't want to be subject to an algorithm. You want to have your story heard and to have your diagnosis be individualized to you.
Mm. Isn't there, on the other hand, I mean, I'm wondering if the pathways conversation is a part of this, but isn't it important to have... Isn't this all part of sort of standardizing medical practice for a good outcome? And by that, I mean, if I end up in an emergency room in Concord, New Hampshire, or Pasadena, California, shouldn't I be able to expect a sort of consistent standard of care? And isn't that one of the things that the effort to impose the pathway and all that, isn't that what that's about?
So you're right to a point. And I think Lena tried to describe where pathways do fit in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
One other way to look at it is they're a threshold. So when you come to the emergency department with chest pain, even before I'm seen by a physician, the standard of care, as it were, would be to get an electrocardiogram, an EKG, within 5 or 10 minutes. The reason being that it may take some time for you to actually see a physician who can take a full history, and let's not waste time if you're actually having a heart attack. Let's get that electrocardiogram. That's an example of a pathway that we would certainly advocate for. But again, those pathways we see as a threshold, that's not the be-all, end-all. You wouldn't stop there. You wouldn't say, well, we've done the EKG, so now we've ruled this in or this out.
Let me see if I can get one more call in. Eddie is calling from Eddie. Eddie, we have about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you to be really quick, but I really want to get your question in.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. I look forward to reading the book. One thing that I've noticed in caring for my elderly parents is there are some great doctors out there who care and take the time. And the doctor explained to me that insurance companies sort of keep them to the grindstone where they have to see so many patients. The amount of time doctors have to spend dealing with insurance companies, they're not just dealing with patients, which, in my opinion, should be their main focus and their only focus.
Right.
It's the business of healthcare that it seems to be ruining healthcare.
The business of healthcare, let me put that on the table. Joshua Kozowski, Eddie raises a big theme that is out there.
Yeah, and with 1 or 2 minutes left, we're not going to solve that problem. It's
right.
Definitely a reality. I think two points. Number one is that listening to patients doesn't necessarily take more time than running batteries of tests and trying to follow up on all those tests, number one. Number two, I think there are some positive reforms happening in the healthcare debate that's going on, but those are going to take some time. And in the short term, what we advocate for patients are things that can work tomorrow at your next doctor's visit.
Well, it's a great and provocative argument, a really interesting book. Joshua Kozowski, Lena Wen, thank you both for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
The book is called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. And listeners, the conversation continues at RadioBoston.org, so you can post your comments and questions there. Stay with us. Coming up, Google Flu Tracker is one way to evaluate the severity of the flu epidemic this year, but how accurate is it? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.